Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. With Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
Gulf Coast in Alabama, Sunday morning. It's, it's a chilly Sunday morning, which is a nice thing. I think it'll be good for you all around. Some of you may have had a little frost. It would be a little premature for some areas to get frost quite this early. Normally, we have most of November to enjoy growing things, but it should have been a light frost. I'll be interested to hear. Whether you had frost. I think probably I'm certain people in near the bay on both sides of the bay probably had no frost at all. As you move away, you're going to see more and more people getting frost. Usually our first frost occurs around Mobile, Fairhope. Usually is occurring about that last day in November, sometimes as late as December 6th. If you're on Dauphin Island, it may be even... Goodness gracious, it may be late in December. If you even have a frost, some years you just don't have a frost on places like Dauphin Island, but most places will have a frost by the end of November, and things will be looking good. One of the things that's happening, though, is we've got this nice cool air. It's going to reduce the number of insects that you have to deal with. It's going to sweeten a lot of plants. You know, you've been growing the broccoli out. I hope you have. Been getting the lettuce up. You taste it and it seems a little bitter. It starts out kind of chocolatey, but then it gets, that's just a little bitter. You know what? This cold weather is really going to help sweeten it up. It's going to make a big difference. Good for that. And the peppers will probably survive. I think the tomatoes have probably about had it. I'll be very interested to hear how the melaton do when we've got this kind of cold, chilly temperatures. Be sure to report on that. But I am thinking a lot here lately about the other thing that happens as it gets cold and chilly. And I'm thinking about the way we see it. I've been thinking a lot about the way we see things, what we see. And one of the things we can see if we look... is the color of fall. It's starting to develop all around. It's that broom sedge, those fields of broom sedge that I love so much. You know, it's just, I can see them in my head. I say the word broom sedge, and it's like the top part of my head just becomes covered with this image of these orange fields, these glowing orange fields in fall. And the little blue-stem grasses, man, it's just like some kind of waxed purple. It's the most beautiful thing on the stems, the color those grasses turn. And the big blue stem turn in beautiful colors. It's an incredible... The leaves on the trees turn colors. And I'm not talking about in Asheville. I'm not talking about getting your car and drive up there and dump your exhaust all over the trees in the Great Smoky Mountains National Park. That happened 3 or 4 weeks ago. You missed it, which is just as well. I'm talking about here in Alabama. The color of the tree leaves is just unbelievable. Unbelievable. All over. We have a lot of green. It's true. And in our suburbs, we tend to favor evergreens for whatever reason. And so we don't always see the color of fall, but there's plenty of color around you. There's plenty of colors in the woods. They're all over the place. And just stunning thing. You know, I woke up this morning and looked out the window, and there was that hickory gold, that unbelievable gold of hickories. Unbelievable gold of hickories. You're going to start seeing it. If you haven't seen it around your house, you're going to see it. Middle part of Alabama, folks are already seeing it. Red Hills, it's already developing. The oaks in South Alabama are going to be developing soon. The maples are probably near their peak right now in the Red Hills of South Alabama. Sugar maples, whatever we want to call them, southern sugar maple, chalky bark maples, they're going to be beautiful. In the swamps, there's incredible stuff. You know what's going to be happening? If it hasn't, it's already there in many places. The black gum's already turned colors. The swamp gum is going to get a little bit of color, but the bicolor pond, the pond tupelo, that's going to be turning colors. So is the swamp maple. That beautiful swamp maple around Mobile, incredible red colors. And then by the end of the month, you're going to start seeing that cypress with that rusty red. The colors are just amazing for fall. And then I get to thinking, now, wait just a minute. Why do these plants turn colors? What's the advantage? You know, it just doesn't seem like it ought to be an accident. Well, what's the advantage? You know, if a goldenrod is yellow in fall, if a lily is pink in summer, if a cardinal flower is red, well, I can tell you, it's red because it wants to attract hummingbirds, maybe, to the flower, because hummingbirds see red really well. And it's yellow because, well, it's got to attract all sorts of insects or whatever. I mean, the colors are, maybe we come up with those kinds of things for color. And we say, yeah, so there's a reason for this color. But here's the problem. What's the reason that trees turn colors? I mean, it seems like they put a lot of effort into it. Or maybe they don't. Maybe it's, as I think sometimes, just the color of the cadaver as it slips into the mold, huh? Maybe that's all it is, just... But, you know, there is that color, and it's so many different kinds of colors. And there has to be some meaning, and I keep thinking about it. And maybe the meaning of this color... And I had this thought of you, but I want you to think about it. Maybe the meaning of this color isn't so much about what the trees want you to see as what we need to see, as what we've evolved to see over many years. I don't think the trees produce color in fall. I don't think those grasses produce color in fall. I don't think there has to be a deliberate reason why they do. But I think there's probably a really deliberate and maybe important reason why we see those things when we're willing to look at them. If colors catch your eye, maybe it's an accident. But oftentimes, I think it means something. It means something real. I'll tell you, the first time I noticed those colors, I was coming over the hill in Rising Fawn, coming back from the mountains and the Smokies. After having survived a fall leaf season where everybody exhausted themselves all over the trees, on the Blue Ridge, and the traffic was backed up because people were looking at those colors, and I thought, what in the world? And I came over the hill in Rising Fawn in Georgia into the hills of Alabama and looked out over there, and it looked nothing like what I left in Asheville. Nobody was paying attention, I suppose. But more importantly, the colors were different. There were colors I had never noticed before in the woods. There were blues and purples and oranges like I had never seen in Asheville. And I remembered them from my childhood. Purples, you think there's not purple in the woods this time of year. You ain't looking. Reds, not the kind of postcard views of the world that we get when we talk about leaf color in Vermont, but the color of diversity in Alabama. That's what you can see. That's what we've evolved to see. The color of diversity. Let's talk about it. You give us a call, 251-343-0106.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Hey, welcome back. Gulf Coast Sunday morning. Sitting here with my seeds going through them, thinking about, what do I need to plant? What do I need to plant? What do you need to plant? You ought to give me a call. We can talk about it. There's still a little bit to be done, a good bit to be done this time of year. A lot of people are getting their garlic in, and that's a good thing. It's fine. You know, I would, for the Gulf Coast, I wouldn't, I think I like it better when the garlic ships a little earlier. It allows us to clip the foliage a little more during the winter. But, you know, I don't know that it does any better than when you plant it right now in terms of bulbing. But it'll be coming in. You'll get it ready. I hope you got a place ready to plant it. Probably, you know, you could, maybe a little premature for things like onions. But you could definitely start them from seed. Wouldn't hurt to start them from seed. Maybe put them out just a little bit later. Sweet peas are certainly something that it's very good to plant right now. Sweet peas. These are not the peas you eat. These are the peas you sniff. The peas with the great colors. You may have forgotten them. I think your grandmother or your great-grandmother may have known them. I wouldn't exclude the fact that your great-granddaddy might have enjoyed them, though he wouldn't have admitted it, perhaps. You know how those guys are. But they're very fragrant. They're very fragrant, the peas. And what a great thing to be planting this time of year. We don't plant them in spring along the Gulf Coast. We plant them in fall. And I think pretty much throughout Alabama, it's best to plant things like sweet peas in fall. Plant them from seeds. That's the nice part. Just plant them from seeds. You don't have to buy the plants. You don't go looking for plants. Nobody's going to have the plants. You plant them from seed. And on the Gulf Coast, it's just about the right time. You know, I think even farther north, it's an interesting experiment. I think probably in Birmingham, I think it's fine to plant this time of year. It's interesting to know whether it would be better to plant in some place like Huntsville, whether it's better to plant, I don't know, early, late, in the fall, I don't know, or better, or wait till spring. I think in general, it's better to plant in fall. Better to plant in fall for those things like peas. Your garlic's coming in. You plant it now. Your fava beans. Oh, man, what a great time to plant fava beans. Great time to do it. And what a great time to plant trees and shrubs of all kinds. Really important. Really important to do it this kind of time of year. The only thing we don't plant... The only thing, and let's just be simple about this, are things that don't do root growth in winter. And there aren't very many of those, but there are a few. One of them would be citrus trees. The other are certain types of tropical palms. They don't do a lot of root growth in winter. You want them to be hardy. And you want them to have roots that are put down really well. And you know, they can desiccate. Freezing is about desiccation. That is lack of moisture. And you kind of compound things when you plant in winter. When they can't develop new roots very quickly, they're going to desiccate more quickly anyway for various reasons because of the... It's just a problem. We don't do that. We wait until spring to plant those things. But most plants, not the tropical plants, but most plants that we grow are going to do fine planted in fall. They're going to put on plenty of root growth because the ground's going to be warm enough. It's not warm enough for citrus to grow. It's not warm enough for some palms to grow. But it's going to be fine for most plants, so you can do that. It's the time for planting. It's a big time for planting. Look at here. 33, Alicia, did you have, did you have any frost last night? I guess you're going to send me a picture. She said it was 33 where she was. Josh said he just got his. And he got, Josh got blossom and lotus garlic. Blossom and lotus garlic, which I think are both really fine. You know, I also have a lot of luck with Thai fire and Thai purple. Chinese purple off and on. I'll be interested to hear. Chinese purple, some years really good, some years not. I'm trying some other varieties this year. I'll let you know. Another one that's really good for those who are ordering garlic and you're interested for next year, you'll call me next year and ask me early. Lortz, L-O-R-T-Z. You ought to ask me about August of next year. L-O-R-T-Z, Lortz Italian, does very well along the Gulf Coast. And it's one of the bigger bulb garlics. It is a more traditional garlic. It's pretty spicy hot, but it's a great garlic. And a great garlic for the Gulf Coast. It comes in early enough that it doesn't get hit hard by the heavy rains of summer. That's one of the big critical things in our garlic along the Gulf Coast is trying to avoid those rains of summer. Farther north, you can experiment more. But some varieties of garlic need a lot of winter cold, so you'll have to worry about some of the hardneck garlics. But you can call me next year, and we'll figure it out. But there's a lot of varieties, more varieties, increasing number of varieties that are really good for us and really interesting. I'm also playing with elephant garlic this year. Elephant garlic's not a true garlic. It's a leek, really. It's sort of a leek, but it's not quite a leek either. It's its own kind of thing. It is, but it produces a big bulb. It's like garlic, except it's like it'll be the size of your fist or bigger. Amazingly big bulbs. And you got to have a big fist. I mean, they're big, big garlic pieces, and they're not hot. Some of the, now I'll be interested. You sample around. Sometimes in the country, and I found a few, you'll find some of the elephant garlics, not all, but some have that wonderful top of the nose heat that good garlic has. It's rare. Most of them are just sweet. They're kind of potatoey, and they're great for cooking with. But some of them have a little bit of heat, a little more spice. You should look around, see what you find. Taste them. Taste the leaves. Tell me what you see. But I'm using elephant garlic, and I think it can be really useful. You know, it is, and I'm using it like I'd use a potato. Don't cook it as much. Just cook it a little bit. Don't have to be too squishy. Throw it into your Thanksgiving turkey. Like as you would onions, really useful kind of stuff. Elephant garlic, and I'm going to be growing more of it to use next summer. It has an onion-like flavor, but very mild, more potatoey. Don't overcook it. I think it's going to be really good in stir fries. That's my bet. I think really good in stir fries, and I haven't done that before, but this year I'm going to try it. It's time to plant that elephant garlic, too. It's really forgiving. Yeah. So, Jim and Georgetown got his garlic, too. Lots of people get. I knew it'd be coming in. I got mine. And so it's coming in all over. You know, a lot of the reason we get bigger garlic, and it has to do sometimes with when you order it. So if you're ordering early... And, Jim, I'll be interested to know if my theory on this is right. When you order early from Fillory Farms, they give you the first dibs. They give you the first dibs on the biggest garlic. And that is generally my thought. I could be completely wrong, but the garlic I get from Fillory is generally larger when I order early. But they always produce usually large garlic. It'll be interesting to hear, but it can be really useful. The small bulbs are good too. In our long season, even the small bulbs can be useful. Don't throw them away. But the big bulbs will generally produce a bigger head of garlic. Often happens that way. I'm looking at the collard porn. This is what it's called. The Alabama blue collards look absolutely beautiful. Absolutely beautiful. Is that this morning? Did they have, you know, they're going to be good. Tell me how they taste now. Just take a little bite off the top. Ought to be a good chocolatey, maybe a little bit of bitterness. That bitterness will go away with cooking. But, you know, pretty soon with this first cold weather, when it gets really cold, when with the first frost, you try it 1st of December, put them in a salad. Just cut them up, put them in a salad. They're delicious after that first frost. We're going to be back.
Me and my best friend Lillian and her blue tick hound dog Gideon, sitting on the front porch, cooling in the shed, singing every song the radio played, waiting for the Alabama sun to go down to red dirt girls in a red dirt town. Me and Lillian just across the line in a little southeast of Meridian.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
All right, welcome back. I'm looking at pictures people sent me. Josh, I didn't see these last week, the pictures that Josh sent me of the pitcher plant bog. I'm trying to figure out why. They probably, because they were big items and were slow to come in, and maybe after, but what beautiful pitcher plants, Josh, just incredibly beautiful. I'm looking at them now. Josh has got this on his hunting lease, and it's obviously a little bog surrounded by a thicket of trees, but it's open in that bog because it's staying pretty wet there, which is nice. And so all of these carnivorous plants are coming up. I see the hat pins. You can see those hat pins, various kinds of hat pins. Boy, there's a bunch of species of them. You got to stay on top of that to remember what all the species are. But there's a bunch of them. All sorts of carnivorous plants. So there's a lot of white top pitcher plants coming up, really beautiful, of all kinds. It looks like, yeah, mostly white tops. Mostly white tops. I'm looking. But down here at the bottom, it appears to me there is a copper top pitcher plant. If you look good, I bet there's a couple of others there. The copper top's the one at the bottom. That's Sarracenia warii, Wary's pitcher plant. It's now Sarracenia alabamensis var warii. I think that's how it works. And it's a pretty rare thing. It's pretty rare. It's pretty nice to see. You know, this would, and Josh, just to say, boy, if you could talk somebody into putting a little fire through there, you don't know how much the hunting would improve, and you don't know how much that pitcher plant would improve. Could be really good. Could be really good. Just putting an idea in your head. Maybe you can put it in somebody else's head, and we'll talk about how that fire works. It's a really easy thing to do there. And you could do it small, just start small. It'll make a big difference in your hunting success. Alicia said she got a little bit of frost, but it melted quickly. It's interesting how frost works. Frost is one of the interesting things we know about frost is that at these temperatures, frost, when it's just on the edge, it's an interaction between temperature and moisture and a bacteria. Isn't that weird? it still strikes me as really odd. But Pseudomonas bacteria, Pseudomonas are pretty well known to doctors and other folks. There's a lot of different kinds of Pseudomonas out there. Some of them are harmless. They all do different kinds of things. Pseudomonas bacteria attack plants. But they have to figure out how they're going to get inside the plant, right? This is fun to think about. And so the Pseudomonas bacteria kind of realized if they can create conditions of super chilling around themselves so that it causes a freezing injury to the plant, essentially a kind of a desiccation of the plant, which creates an entry wound into the plant, the Pseudomonas bacteria can get into the plant. Isn't that crazy, wild, weird? And that's what happens with frost at about 33, 34, 35, 36 degrees. Those Pseudomonas bacteria are playing a big role. They're increasing the likelihood that the plant freezes. So there's been a lot of work done in trying to control the activity of Pseudomonas bacteria, and you'll see some anti-frost things that are about controlling the amount of Pseudomonas bacteria on your plant so that you can control frost damage. Interesting, isn't it? Well, a lot of the frost you're seeing is the work of not only the temperature, but those Pseudomonas bacteria trying to find a way to sneak into your plant. Chew on the inside of your plant. Get under its defenses. There it is. What else have we got to do? White spot on the palms. I'm going to wait for that picture to come in. I'd like to. So Josh is sending me a message. A timber company. Sometimes you can maybe talk them into it. One of the things you can do if you've got a hunting lease with a timber company, a suggestion is you might say to them, look, we can help you control your asset to protect your asset here by helping you with a fire. Some of them may go for it. They may appreciate that. I'd work with them. That's a beautiful place. And depending on which timber company, we might talk about that. Some of them could be very open to that kind of thing. So someone is asking me, look at that. Jim and Georgetown. He's dragging Ms. Agnes to her final resting spot in a burn pile. That's good, Ellie Agnes, Miss Agnes. Some people call it Ugly Agnes. You don't want it in your yard. You don't want it in the wild. It can be a problem. It's a problem. Jim got wise. Jim got rid of it. So I was afraid of this. Somebody sent me, Perry sent me some pictures. We've been seeing a lot of this. Pictures of what he called a palm leaf. And I thought, well, maybe he means it's a cycad palm. And it is indeed a cycad palm, which is not a true palm at all. It's a cycad. Sago palm, we call it. But it's not a palm. It's a sago palm. Common names are a problem. It's cycad scale. And it's pretty bad. We talked about this. And I've been thinking about how I say this because I feel so bad about saying it out loud. So somebody sent me a picture the other day and said, gosh, goodness gracious, we just moved down here. Somebody said our sago palm has cycad scale. What can we do about it? And I said, say bye-bye to that palm, to that cycad, to that sago. because once you get this scale, you're not going to be able to control it. I mean, it is so intensive. The effort is so I can give you a prescription for it, but it's going to take repeated treatments, and I mean repeated. You're going to spend more time on that sago than that sago could possibly be worth to anybody. I mean, unless it held the spirit of your ancestors. And if it held the spirit of your ancestors, then, okay, well, we'll figure something out. But it shouldn't hold the spirit of your ancestors because it came from somewhere, probably where your ancestors didn't come from. And it was something you bought in a, somebody bought in a Walmart for whatever. It's not a great ancestral, it's not a great repository of ancestral spirits. It's just a sago palm. And there are many things in life that are as good or better than sago palms. Right now, that sago palm has got cycad scale. It is virtually untreatable in any kind of conventional sense. You would have to spray it. You can spray it with horticultural oil repeatedly. But I'm talking about repeatedly. Mostly what's going to happen is the scale is going to reappear. It's going to reappear fairly quickly. And you're going to have to spray it again and again and again. And somebody's going to tell you to use, oh, something else on it. Which is then going to make your plant more susceptible to the scale, because the few insects that do eat the scale will be susceptible to the other things that you add to the... Oh, it's just a terrible circle. Systemic insecticides don't work that well on cycad scale. It's a long list of problems. It's boring for me to talk about why you can't control cycad scale. It's just boring. So I don't want to have to talk about it too much. I just want to say, find something better. Find something better. Don't drop the cycads. Don't drop your sago when you dig it up or cut it off. You just cut it off. Don't dump it in your neighbor's yard. Burn it if possible, I reckon. It's spreading. The cycad scale is spreading. We brought it in a few years ago. It's infecting a lot of plants. We also brought in some predators that can control the cycad scale, but they're moving a little more slowly. I don't think they'll ever quite catch up. And I think sagos, we had our sago phase. I think we're probably going to be a few generations before we have our cycad thing again with Asian cycads, because they're very susceptible to the scale. And we brought the scale in just like we brought the sagos in. There it is. There it is. It's a, you know, I want to say it's a sad story, and I want to feel sad with you if we need to feel sad for a minute, but I don't feel all that sad. They're nice. Sago palms are nice. You know, I figured out what to do with them. They got to be, for a while they'd grow so well, they were so big and rangy, you just had to figure out how am I going to manage this thing? And I had fun figuring out how to manage them, but, you know, in the end, there's better things in life than sago palms. And that palm is going to be a problem for you the rest of its life. Shorten its life and you'll have a longer one. Did I say that? Yeah, I think I did. Don't worry with those sago palms. Once they get the disease, don't plant sago palms, by the way. I'll tell you, don't plant them because they're going to be really susceptible to disease. We're going to be back. You can give us a call, you know. I don't know if you've thought about that, but you can call us 251-343-0106. We can talk to you directly. Tell you as much as we can tell you. You can also text me. Same number. Let's hear from you.
With my mangoes and waving black hair, with the roses so red and the lilies so fair.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
All right, welcome back. Gulf Coast Sunday morning. Wayne sent me a picture. Wayne, I don't know how it happened. He sent me the same picture 15 times, which is okay. And I think that's about the number of times that he got stung, as I'm guessing. And maybe that's the significance of it. By the Yellow Jackets that he unearthed while working in the yard. He said it was in a stand of pampas grass. I'm not particularly fond of pampas grass for some various reasons, but it does seem that, and I don't want to be unfair to it as a result, but it does seem that pampas grass does seem to encourage Yellow Jackets, but so do some other things. Yeah, watch out for them. I don't know how to tell you. I don't know how to tell you how to watch out for them. I mean, you'll know when you've got tangled in them. Jim, anybody got any ideas about how to watch out for Yellow Jackets? You let me know, Wayne. Some beautiful pictures coming in this morning. Ted sent me a picture of ironweed still blooming. Isn't that beautiful? Which ironweed is that? Ironweed. Like Iron Man. Ironweed. I-R-O-N. Weed. Ironweed. I don't know why it's called ironweed. I have no idea. There's nothing ironish about it, is there? It needs a better name. We need lots of better names. We don't do names well at all. I don't know why. I mean, we said we believe in the Bible and all that kind of stuff, and then we go off and the Bible says you got to name this stuff, and then we don't follow through. You know, look at Genesis. So it says you go name it. It's your problem. And then we don't name it. We come up with crazy names like ironweed for something that looks nothing like iron. I don't get it. Maybe it's we should think about that one. It's man, what do we call that? It's a big purple weed. I mean purple. It's intense purple. It's incredible purple. What a deep, rich purple color. We ought to think about a better name for that. But there it is. Ironweed. Vernonia is the Latin name. We have to be a little more careful when we talk about, when we use Latin. We actually have names for it. Vernonia. Vernonia. It's a good thing. I feel bad. I feel bad about the cycad thing. And I know it's sad. I know it's sad when people have to hear that their cycad has cycad scale, and that there's not really a sensible way of dealing with it that I'm aware of. And so I hold out the opportunity, and I always say this, I want someone to come and say, Bill Finch doesn't know what he's talking about. He has no idea that you can solve this cycad scale problem so easy. So I encourage you, if you've been able to solve this cycad scale problem for more than a few days, more than a few weeks, more than a few months, let's say you've been able to cure your cycad scale and it was pretty bad and you've been able to keep it suppressed for more than a year and a half and it didn't, I'd be interested to hear how you did it. We'd all be interested to hear how you did it. Just to be fair, we need to know. It would be good to know. Because it's a bad problem out there. And it is somewhat sad. I just want to say, it ain't the saddest thing in the world. Given the fact that it's what it is. It ain't the saddest thing we'll have to encounter. And there's so many. It's going to give you a great space for something maybe even neater. Maybe something neater. You know, we're going to have the same problem, and I say this over and over. We don't think about our actions. We don't think about what we're doing. We're going to have the same, I'm going to have to tell you the same sad story about citrus if we're not careful. And I'm going to be following up on it. But we may be, we've got some important citrus diseases coming in. And we hope they're isolated. We hope they stay isolated. But it's already getting to be much harder for me to recommend citrus to you, because I know they're going to be hard to find because of these diseases. And I know there's going to be quarantines. And I know that it's possible that we're going to be careless. It's not only possible, it's probable that we're going to be careless and bring in some of these diseases that are affecting citrus. I just, when you look at that cycad scale and you say, man, how did that happen? Well, we did it. We weren't careful. We aren't careful about what we bring in. We don't really have the barriers. We don't have the money to put into the barriers that keep these diseases from coming in. We don't think it's important. We're cavalier about it as a group of people, as individuals. And so we bring stuff in. When you can fly stuff in on a plane from China, ain't nothing wrong with China. China's a nice place. Maybe. I haven't been there. But I suspect it's a great place, given the number of interesting plants that come from China. Suspect it was much better at one time, but, you know, it's what it is. But it ain't China's fault. It's the fact that we aren't careful about how we bring things in. And so we brought in the cycad scale. And it's just like we brought in the cycads. And it's been a big problem. I just encourage you to think about that. Maybe it's useless. Maybe I know that we're going to get it no matter what. But it's going to be sad for me to have to say, let's find something better than citrus, because citrus ain't going to grow here anymore because we brought in these diseases, and it's just not a good control for them. Greening, citrus greening, is devastating Florida right now. It's devastating the Florida citrus industry. Find somebody who will argue with that. I mean, it's unbelievable the impact it's had on the citrus industry in Florida. It's on its last legs there. It's a real problem. Beautiful looking stuff from Tony on Fowl River. The purple mustard just looks great. You know, it's great to have that purple mustard ready for turkey at Thanksgiving, because you can put it on a sandwich, and it's just like you're not eating turkey. It's like the best stuff in the world. It's so good to have it fresh. So good to have it fresh. Your peppers are still making. Oh, it's so good. What do I suggest as a replacement for scale-infested sago? Well, there's a bunch of things. We're going to come back after break, and we're going to talk about that. That's a great thing.
Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast, with Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
Welcome back, Gulf Coast Sunday morning. You know, I want to talk about this seeing thing, and I guess, the colors of fall. And why do we see them? Why? You know, I'm just going to say, because it keeps coming to my mind, I love my dog. I got a great dog. He's a wonderful dog. You know, he's a dog. However, he doesn't see well. He doesn't see what I see. And I think about that. I'm in the woods with him in the fall, and he's getting his own sense of fall from whatever sense he has, but he's not seeing what I'm seeing in the woods. He's not seeing those beautiful colors that I'm seeing. And I think, why is that? What is that? I think he's more focused. I think he's more focused in his sight. His sight is, and he's got other senses that sort of make up for it. But I don't think he has that sense of how many different things there are out there with those colors that we can see. And we can see great diversity in nature if we try. A lot of times we think, oh, well, I'll see like a dog sees. I'll see like a dog sees. I'll say that again. I'll see only a few colors, and only the most vivid colors. Only, you know, I'm going to see things like a postcard. I'm going to wait for things, and we don't have patience to see the diversity of colors, which is what Alabama brings to us, this diversity of colors. I'd love to think about seeing in Alabama how we came to see like we see. Let's think about it. There was a great boundary. They call it the KT boundary. Can you believe I'm doing this? Cretaceous-Tertiary boundary. Happened about, what, 80, 90 million years ago. Big asteroid dropped down in the middle of the Gulf of Mexico. Boom. Right off the Yucatan Peninsula. Boom. Wiped out everything, but it didn't wipe out eyes and noses. Eyes and a sense of smell, sense of taste, those things survived and redeveloped again in that free-form way that allows things to make choices, that allows life to make choices. And we made choices over those 90 million years about what we would see in one way or another. Our ancestors did, and what we're left with is this incredible sense of color. Just really beautiful. I love what we can see. And maybe it means something when we see all these different colors. There it is. I said it. Jim in Georgetown says he can't see how you know when you're going to run across yellow jackets. Jim is also a nice enough guy. This is how nice Jim is. Jim is so nice that he says he wouldn't wish yellow jackets on his worst enemy. That's nice of you, Jim. That is just nice of you. Vanna, let's talk about this cycad scale. Thank you for holding on. It's a good, and I, you know, you're going to bring up an important topic here. I can see it coming. Vanna, tell me about your experience with cycad, with the scale on your cycads.
We've lived in this home in Gulf Shores for almost 18 years, and there were, let's see, at least five fully grown sagos here in the landscape plan when we moved here, and they are all still here and doing well. The main problem I have with them is once in a while they try to make an extra head, you know, and then like
right. That's where
branches going every which way. But we've had the cycad scale, and I just have sprayed it with the horticultural oil, like you said, a long time ago. And we've had it probably the scale for the last 10 years, even, and we just keep spraying and make sure that we spray up underneath the leaves where the scale is, and all over, and the trunk, and everything. And really, I know they're not maybe perfect. I went out and took a picture one, but I can't figure out how to send it. I'm so bad with this phone. Anyway, eventually I'll send it. But they're still in the places they were, and one at the front, which is really beautiful, right by the front door and the porch, has been cut all the way back to nothingness. And absolutely came out beautiful again. So, you know, so, I think it's livable. If you like them for landscape purposes and you don't mind spraying every 3 or 4 months or whatever it is, I don't know how often would be too often. That's what you should maybe let us know. But
that's a tough one.
I don't mind it. And they're so lovely looking from a distance in the landscape. I'm glad they're still there, frankly.
That's good. So a couple of things that I should mention.
Uh-huh.
There are many scales that affect cycads. Do you remember when did this infestation first start for you? When did you first notice it?
I can't remember, but I know it's been at least 6 or 7 or more years.
Yeah.
That's
about right. When it happened, was it completely covered with white?
Just underneath. No, it's never been completely covered with white because I'm out there pulling weeds and stuff, and I notice things quickly.
Yeah. So did anyone actually tell you it was
underneath and top and bottom and the trunk?
A couple of things that are worth noting. There are several other scales that affect cycads occasionally. One is Magnolia scale, and the other is, which is pretty common, and I think Oleander scale also can affect cycads, and they're much easier to control. It's possible that your scale is not cycad scale, and I should clarify this.
Well, yeah, because it's not all white. No, they're green and beautiful.
Yeah, so I think you probably have a Magnolia scale. And certainly I wouldn't. You're keeping it pretty under control. I tended to ignore Magnolia scale when it got on the cycad because it really wasn't very visible and it didn't do a whole lot of damage.
It's underneath only.
But this is important, and you have been very good to allow me to say this out loud because I should have said this a while back. Some people who have problems with cycad scale actually have Magnolia scale. The pictures that I got, and you should see some of the pictures if you haven't, go look them up, Vanna, because they're really impressive. People who have cycad scale, it looks like, you know those Christmas trees that you get that have got like white sprayed all over them, flocked Christmas trees?
Mm-hmm.
That's what it looks like.
No kidding. You're probably right, and maybe this is not the cycad scale.
Yeah, and not everybody gets the cycad scale. I think most people get the Magnolia scale to some degree, and people who have sharp eyes like you will notice it and say, ooh, I could take care of this with some horticultural oil, and you do. Cycad scale is another beast altogether. You can drive by it. If you've got cycad scale, here's the clue. Take your car and drive by your front yard at 60 miles an hour, and if you notice that you've got a scale, you've got cycad scale. If you have to get up close to see it, it's probably Magnolia scale or Oleander scale.
And so
this is very useful. Very good, and I am so glad. Now, I'm not going to rule out you had cycad scale, but I think that it's probably Magnolia and Oleander scale.
Because it's never been white, other than you look up under the leaves and you see this little stuff attached.
But when you called and you said you've had it for 18 years, I thought this is so good because I've never talked about these other scales before.
Okay, I'll do some reading on the computer.
Yeah, check to see. We got to take a break.
Okay.
Yeah, Vanna, thank you. Oh, boy, that was a fortunate call. I'm glad you called. We'll be back to talk a little bit more about the cycad scale.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
There you go. Hey, let's get back to some of these really great questions. Ted sent me some great photos and texts. Not only the ironweed, which is that beautiful purple thing, Vernonia, Gigantea, Vernonia missouriensis. I don't know which one. I'd have to look carefully. Can't tell from this picture. But it's beautiful ironweed, one of the big, beautiful ironweeds. He also sent me a great picture of a cardinal flower. That's the red thing. Isn't that, aren't they beautiful? And a beautiful picture of a cypress somewhere, oh, upper delta. And then he sends me a picture, Ted sends me the picture of, he's really enjoying the results of not mowing the last 2.5 years. Boy, am I enjoying that too. I mean, it just gives me such pleasure to look at that picture, Ted. It's beautiful longleaf coming up, beautiful longleaf pines coming up, just coming up like they're supposed to do. Along with grasses everywhere, you know, I think broom sedge, but I do see some foxgloves in there, false foxglove, agilinus, pretty little pink things. See all the little pink things in there? Beautiful pictures, Ted. I know you're going to have a lot more coming up. It's getting to the point, because he's got some popcorn trees coming in. It's getting to the point, Ted, where you're probably going to need to get a little serious about it. So if you don't mow for a while, you get some great wildflowers, but then then stuff happens, like this really miraculous stuff starts happening, like you get longleaf pines coming in. And then you don't want to mow because a longleaf pine is an incredible thing. And if you don't mow, eventually you're going to get lots of briars and popcorn trees, which are coming. Where do the popcorn trees come from? Well, they come out of the zoot suit of a bird. You know what I'm saying? Birds are carrying those seeds. They're going to drop them. Charlie's back on. He doesn't allow me to say what happens. You know, he keeps track of that. So I'm not going to say it out loud, but it comes out of the zoot suit of a bird. And so there it is. You're going to get those kinds of things coming in, and they can take over. So how did longleaf forests get along naturally? Well, they had fire, and it was natural. And you're at just a perfect stage where I think we can talk about fire in a very easy and controlled way. We ought to talk about that, Ted, because I think you're ready for it. You're ready for it. You got it compartmentalized. I think you're going to be able to handle it. Let's just do some small burns. You're going to get more comfortable with it. It could be a beautiful thing. It could be a really beautiful thing. Let's talk about it sometime. You're getting ready for it. Now, I have told other people, you know, you don't have to mow all the time, and it's nice to see those wildflowers coming up, and I'm saying, I'm promising they don't have to burn. But once you start getting the longleaf in, and if you want to keep the longleaf, you're going to have to start thinking about, how do I use fire? Because otherwise, you can't use mowing anymore because you'll ruin your longleaf. There it is. There it is. So, Keith is congratulating Charlie for keeping my mouth clean of words like, you know what. So there it is. What else we got? Is it too late to plant turnip seeds? So this is a great question. And no, it's not too late. There's a lot of things you can plant now. The question is, when are you going to harvest it? A lot of things that you can plant now, including broccoli or cabbage or whatever else, is not going to be ready to eat before Christmas. It's going to develop slowly, and it's going to be ready. This is along the Gulf Coast I'm talking about right now. It's going to develop slowly, and it's going to be ready February, March, if you don't mind waiting. Turnips could be the same way, if depending on the variety, because things start growing a little slower this time of year. It's the cool weather a little bit, but it's mostly the shorter days. It's just not as much sunlight. So if I were going to plant turnips, I would plant something like all tops if I wanted to harvest them in December. All tops, I think you'd get a great harvest in December. because it doesn't put any effort into roots. It's just about the tops. And if you just want the turnip greens, try something like All Tops. Yeah, there's lots of them out there. But you don't want to put a lot of effort into roots if you want to harvest it before Christmas. If you don't mind waiting until after Christmas, you can plant lots of whatever turnip you like. And there's some great ones out there. Turnip roots, turnip bottoms, as well as the tops. And it just may be that the harvest is a little bit later. But no, it's not too late to plant those. What else have we got here? A beautiful cycad growing along the bay. It is pretty. It's well trimmed. That's Vanna's picture of her cycad. Vanna, I would say you've done a nice job of trimming it up. It's beautiful looking. I would say my guess is that you did not have cycad scale, but you had magnolia scale, and that's pretty easy to control. The cycad scale spreads from plant to plant. The scale insects don't move readily, easily from plant to plant. They get moved around. We move them in trash. We move them. There's lots of ways they can get moved around. So you want to be careful about that. If you do have cycad scale and you're getting rid of your cycad, don't dribble it all over your neighbor's property. Just being nice. It's probably better to bag those leaves in the trash in a really stiff bag because the leaves will poke through. But bag the leaves once you cut them off of your plant. Just bag the leaves. You might even want to bag the trunk. You might want to burn it if you can. That's what a problem cycad scale is. There it is. Something to think about. So, what else we got? What else have we not dealt with this morning that we ought to be dealing with here? Let's see. Right. I knew there was something else. What do you suggest as a replacement for our scale-infested sago? And Bill and Adrian, let me make sure, and let's be fair, and let's come back to you. I think you noticed this cycad because it was covered in white scales. I mean, covered. Covered. And if you only see a little bit of scale and it's on the bottoms and it doesn't look like it's one of those flocked Christmas trees. You know what I'm saying? Did I say it right? Isn't that what they call them? Flocked Christmas trees? That's how your sago should look if it has cycad scale. It just looks completely covered in this dusty white thing. It's kind of interesting. I'm reluctant to call it pretty, but in some cases it might even look pretty for a little while until the sago palm starts dying. But that's how it looks if it's only got a few scale, and if you're standing across the yard and you don't even know it's got scale, then you don't have cycad scale, more than likely, and it's treatable. That's good. Thank you, Vanna, that was an important omission. Thank you, Vanna, for making me think about that and for letting me talk about that. But Bill and Adrian, I think, given the fact that you were able to quickly identify scale issues, and I think you're kind of really relatively new to the area, that it was very noticeable. Pretty sure you got cycad scale. So we said, take it out. What are you going to put there? Man, what can't you put there? Almost any cool thing. So the thing you want to do is figure out, well, gosh, you know, what would I really like? Maybe I just want something pretty. Maybe I just want something pretty. And I kind of need to know a little bit about where you are. You're on Fort Morgan. Certainly you could try, there's a lot of great native plants that you could try there. And that would be fine. They would do fine. Maybe you just want something pretty. Maybe you want something nice to eat. That would be nice. You can walk out in your yard and just pick it off the tree. In which case, I'd say, well, a jelly palm would be very nice. A pindo palm or a jelly palm would be very, very nice. A persimmon would be great. Love persimmons. They're really wonderful. But give me, let's talk. Let's see what you might want, and we can figure out what to put there. Give us a call, 251-343-0106.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
All right, welcome back. Gulf Coast Sunday morning. Jim, what a challenge. To look at these seedlings, it's clearly a monocot, Jim. It's clearly something like an arum, which could be Jack in the Pulpit. Could also be elephant ear at this stage. I'm not sure I can tell the difference at this stage fully. But I'm thinking probably, I think it's, if you think it's a Jack in the Pulpit, I would say, yeah, it's in that group somewhere. It's close by. It's clearly not, it's clearly an arum. And Jack in the Pulpit's an arum. There are other arums out there, but I think that's probably what it is. There it is. Somebody sent me a picture of little yellow orange things on their milkweeds. There are little yellow orange things on my milkweed. I thought they were monarch eggs. And then I saw them moving. Yes, that's interesting. So, well, it is interesting, isn't it? So we cherish the monarchs, which are insects that eat milkweed. But we don't cherish other insects that eat the milkweed too, that have evolved with the milkweed. And in this case, they're milkweed aphids. They evolved with milkweeds. They occur on milkweed pretty frequently when you grow milkweeds. And sometimes they can make the milkweed look a little raggedy, but so can monarchs when they eat the milkweed. It's an interesting problem, isn't it? So what are you going to do? You're going to put a systemic insecticide on there to stop the aphids? Well, then you're going to stop the monarchs. Interesting problem, ain't it? One thing I might suggest is take a hose and spray the aphids off. You won't get rid of them. You'll have to spray them with a hose, but a hose ain't, you know, water's water. We got enough of it that you can afford to spray your milkweed plants. Just spray them with a fine hose. You'll wash them off. They'll be back a little bit at a time, but you'll keep the plant from looking ragged. Or you can tolerate them, you know. You can tolerate them is another way of doing it. Really, a milkweed should not be blooming this late anyway. Probably you have a tropical milkweed from a butterfly's perspective. I'm not sure that's a good thing to have a plant that blooms continuously for so long, because it can harbor diseases. It can harbor diseases if a single plant has been producing flowers for a long time. Then that's a, you know, it's a concern in some cases. Maybe you cut it back at this time. And clean it up. But it's about time for the milkweeds to quit blooming. The tropical milkweeds will still bloom. And if you want them just for looks, you don't care about the monarchs, you can try to keep them blooming by spraying the aphids off. If you care about the monarchs, I might say just cut them back, because it's really not great for the monarchs this time of year. They'd probably be rather sucking on other things that don't that might not harbor disease quite so well, because the flowers tend to appear only once a year in fall rather than continuously throughout the year on the same plant. That's one way to think about it. You're probably not going to want to think about it that hard. But if you're trying to save monarchs, it's the kind of thing we need to think about. If you're just growing a plant, it probably doesn't matter. Probably doesn't matter. Though there are better plants to grow than tropical milkweeds if you're just growing a plant. Maybe. Garden, Alicia, that's good. Alicia, sorry, you had to ask twice, is asking me about what kind of plants can be grown with garlic and where garlic is grown. I will tell you, you don't want to grow garlic in the same place year after year, absolutely. And you want to grow, and that's also true for onions. In other words, you don't want to grow garlic. You want to, if you're going to grow garlic and onions, you might as well grow them together, because you don't want to grow garlic this year where you grew onions last year, because they share diseases. And there's lots of bulbing issues that can develop on garlic and onions. Now, here's an interesting problem. And that is that mini gardens, M-A-N-Y, not mini gardens, not M-I-N-I, but mini gardens, M-A-N-Y, have wild onions growing in them. They have wild onions growing in the lawn. And these wild onions, I suspect, harbor many of the same diseases that cultivated onions harbor. The wild onions are probably more resistant to those diseases. They probably don't suffer from them as badly, but they can continue to carry them. And so there's a possibility that those diseases are in the soil. And so sometimes it's a good idea to plant your garlic in places that has been out of the lawn, that's not been in lawn for a while. I discovered that. How did I know that? Because I figured it out. Because it messed up my garlic. But so all that's pretty important. Yes, you don't want to grow garlic and onions in the same place where you grew garlic and onions last year. And ideally, you don't want to grow garlic and onions in a place that had lawn with things like wild onion in it the previous year. So there it is. But sometimes we do what we have to do. I will tell you that I have also grown garlic in places where there was wild onion the year before, and I didn't have a disease problem. I do think that certain years that are particularly wet, in soils that stay particularly wet and that don't drain well, you're more likely to have those kinds of disease problems. If the soil stays wet and chilly for a long period of time, you're more likely to have those kinds of disease problems. Alicia, I can tell because she's created a box in which she put soil into it, is probably going to have pretty reasonably good drainage. It's not too high. It's only about, what, a couple of 2x4s high. And that's okay. It's still reasonably hydrologically connected to the ground underneath, so it's going to drain reasonably well. If it's too high, you can run into drainage problems, believe it or not. It's more like a pot, and you have to be careful about the kinds of soils that you put in there, and you have to manage it a little differently. But at that height, you can treat it as if it's ground, and I think it's going to be raised just enough, just a few inches ultimately. I hope that's not a liner, as long as it's not lined. You didn't line it, did you? If it's lined, we may have a problem, Alicia. But as long as you didn't line that soil bed with plastic or anything like that, you should be okay. I think you're probably not going to have those diseases. Not going to plant those diseases. Not going to have those diseases where you planted. All right, good. Craig, I'm listening. Tell me what's up.
All right, Bill. So I've got some banana plants, I guess you would call them, bushes, trees, whatever we want to call them, in my yard. I cut them all back last year, and they came up, oh, boy, I probably had 20, 10 or 15 last year, and they came up about 15 or 20. Several of them are producing bananas, but only about, I'll say, six or seven bananas on the stalk, if you will, but they're only 2 inches long. What am I doing wrong? Are they too young?
So you've kind of figured it out, if you'll think about it. So what you've demonstrated is that it takes about 7 to 8 months before that banana plant from the ground, 6 to 8 months before the banana plant coming out of the ground will produce a flower. Right? So
okay.
It came up in March. Let me use my fingers here. March, April, May, June, July, August, September. It probably flowered in what? August, October? Did it start flowering in
yep.
October? When you know? Yep. So
yep.
That's actually, how many fingers is that? That looks like 8 fingers. So it took about 8 months, that's about right, for that banana plant to flower.
Okay.
From scratch. So coming up from the ground, it takes about 8 months. And
all right.
And that means that the fruit are not going to have enough time to mature because it's going to be too cold. And they don't like temperatures below 45 degrees.
All right.
So that means, well, you got flowers, you got incipient fruit, and for all for naught. But some of us, you may have heard, have been able to eat bananas that we produced in our yard. How did we do it? We borrowed time from the previous year.
Okay.
So here you go. What happens is you got a clump there, and at this point you might as well just leave it where it is. The clump that's the thing that's got bananas on it, just, you know, you have it there to make pretty. Do not cut your plant back.
Okay.
This winter, because you're going to have lots of stalks that will likely survive the winter. Even if you don't do anything, if we have a mild winter, and it's more likely than not that we're going to have a milder winter this year because of La Nina. And that means one of those stalks, and preferably one about 7 feet high, it will be about 7 feet high in March, will continue to grow. It'll come out of its winter doldrums, and it will start growing, and it will already be 7 feet high. So you borrowed a bunch of months, and that means in July, that plant will flower, and you will need 90 days from the time it flowers for that fruit to mature. Mid-July, August, September, October, that means in mid-October, you could have edible bananas.
Excellent.
Now, what's going to happen is in spring, you need to call me because we're going to say, I don't want you to keep all of those stalks. I only want you to keep a few because I don't want them competing with each other. So we'll talk about that in spring. But you got to borrow that time from the year before. So you're going to borrow 7 months of growth and transfer it to next year.
All right. Well, thank you, Bill.
All right. You're welcome, Craig.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
All right, here we go. Yeah, I'm looking at Alicia's formula for her beds, and I think it's going to work out just fine. Not too much. Okay, these are your own chickens. That's good. You don't need a lot of it. I think that'll be good. Always remember, mostly extra small pine bark. That's good. That's good. Hard lime. That's good. Micronutrient mix. Yeah, that's probably okay. And chicken poop. I think it'll all be fine. I think you're going to do well with that. Crack the soil underneath your bed, Alicia. She's got her bed laid out here. Well, she's got it two boards high, just two by fours high. Well, no, maybe it's a little higher. 24 inches. Doesn't look 24 inches, but okay, maybe it is. Boards are bigger than I thought. I see, because it's sloping, isn't it? So you got it sloped. I think that's still going to be okay. I try to encourage people, don't make your beds too high. You can make them too high, and you can run into problems. But I think you're probably going to be okay. Jim is always making crazy stuff out of fruits. And not crazy stuff. He made a banana wine. I had a banana rum at one point. Jim, it was the worst thing I think I've ever put in my mouth. I mean, if you can imagine... paint thinner flavored with banana. That was kind of how it tasted. But, Jim, I know you're going to do better. With that banana wine. I'm sure it was really good, and it did not taste like paint thinner flavored with banana extract. And the paint thinner was a little stronger flavored than the banana extract. Ted has sent me a great photo of a beautiful violet. A violet, maybe most people wouldn't, as Ted says, take time to notice, but it's beautiful, absolutely beautiful thing. He did a great job taking a picture of it. Beautiful white violet with a purple throat. Violets, we tend to undervalue the violets. We got a bunch of them in Alabama. We're probably coming up with new species all the time. There's a lot of underappreciated violets, many colors. You know, you got yellow violets, you got white violets with blue throats, you got purple violets, you got blue violets with white throats, you got all sorts of different types of violets, different flower shapes, really interesting. I hesitate to even start looking and trying to understand them all. I'll be honest, because there's so many of them, and they require different sorts of ways of thinking about how do I tell one species from another. But they're out there. They're beautiful. They're really great to look at. Really nice thing to know about all those great little violets. What else have we not covered this morning? I hope I was clear about the bananas. You know, we haven't talked about them as much. We hadn't talked about them as much as we used to. We had a cold winter last year. They got pretty ragged. I think probably there were a lot fewer bananas this year than there were in the years past. Chances are reasonably good that this winter will not be as cold as the last winter. So let me tell you how to think about it. Because here's the great thing. Bananas are just wonderful. They're wonderful. You can't do this. Certainly can't. I wouldn't recommend even trying this north of Monroeville. But along the Gulf Coast, it's really a great pleasure to trying things like Orinoco. A great banana, undervalued banana. Orinoco, absolutely delicious. You could eat them soft, or you can even cook them when they're a little hard. Actually, I think I probably prefer them when you can cook them. They're almost like plantain-like. It's like a weird cross between a plantain and a banana, and absolutely delicious either way. It's when it's ripe, it's this creamy, lemony, banana-like thing that's just beautiful, wonderful, so much better than the grocery store bananas. And when it's not quite ripe, you can actually cook it as if it's a plantain. Really beautiful, and it's a great thing then too. Orinoco's great. What's being sold is Rajapuri. I have no idea what it was originally. I don't think anybody else does either. But it's now called Rajapuri. You see it sold a lot. Both of those start fruiting fairly early. They don't need a tremendous amount of growth before they start flowering and fruiting. So you can get them earlier in the year. They're both delicious, both great. The key is you've got to borrow some growth from one year and carry it over to the other. And the only way to do that is not to cut it back in winter. Very simple, right? Now, if it's a cold winter, it can help. If you've got leaves, you can just dump it on there. Dump it in there where the stalks are coming out to protect them from the cold. Those leaves help. They actually decompose and actually release heat, which can help. I used to do that. Used to go to a lot of trouble. And it was worth it. I will say it's absolutely worth it. You can even drop leaf bags in there. The leaf bags in and amongst the plants. Cover the plants with those leaf bags. That's great, too. But the key is you need, in March, you want to start with a stalk that's about 7 feet high. Now, I will tell you that the 1st of March, that stalk may be brown on the outside. The leaves will certainly be brown. The leaves will certainly be brown. But if it's still standing, the chances are very good that the core of that stalk is solid and it will emerge in late March, early April, and start growing. And you've already got a tremendous amount of growth there that's ready to start flowering. Now, if you wait, if you have a larger stalk, this is a technicality, but I need you to listen. If you've got a larger stalk that, say, it's 9 feet high, you think, oh, man, I got really something great to start with. The problem is those it's going to choke a little bit because those bananas are in the stalk, forming in the stalk. That's what bananas do. And they've probably already formed during the winter, and there was a growth check, and those bananas are not going to be as good. They're going to have a hard, pithy core because they were forming while it was still cold. So it's those intermediate height stalks along the Gulf Coast that we learn to work with, about 6 feet high, 5 feet high, 6 feet high, 7 feet high. Those are the perfect ones. So you allow them to stay over winter. It's not bad to allow the other stalks that are taller to protect it, which they will do. They'll protect the smaller ones because they're kind of creating a canopy there that protects them, keeps them a little warmer. It's not bad to throw some leaf bags in there to keep them even warmer. You can do that if you're really serious about it. And then when spring comes, you cut out the big stalks. You leave those two or three stalks 5 feet high, and there you go. We can talk about that, but we'll have to do it another time. Check with us next week.